Welcome to today's edition of Centered, a reasonable conversation about life and faith with your host, Dr. Don Belenis, PhD.
What do you think of bumper stickers? Our guest today uses short bumper sticker mottos to illustrate the wide variety of ethical rules about right and wrong that operate in our culture today. Steve Wilkins teaches philosophy and ethics in the School of Theology at Azusa Pacific University in Azusa, California. He's also taught at Mount St. Antonio College, Glendale Community College, and Fuller Theological Seminary. The second edition of his very readable primer on ethics has just come out, and it's titled Beyond Bumper Sticker Ethics, An Introduction to Theories of Right and Wrong. Welcome back to Centered, Steve.
Well, it's terrific to be back with you again.
Interesting book, interesting title, and that's what I want to ping on first. Bumper stickers in our culture, from my point of view, are both transient because we generally read them while we're zipping around in traffic. They don't make a big, long statement. And at the same time, they're evidence of some sort of a commitment because people stick them to their vehicles, sometimes for weeks, months, or I've seen even years. How did bumper stickers provide you with launching points for this book?
Well, it was almost accidental. I was teaching an ethics class probably more than 20 years ago and trying to explain a particular theory, and it just hit me as appropriate. Well, this theory can really be summed up in this quick little phrase that, you know, has become part of the common currency of our language. And as I reflected on that, I thought, well, you know, just about all of the major theories have some kind of corresponding saying that would be quite familiar to people. And this led to the further realization that whether we acknowledge it or not, we do kind of think of ethics in theoretical terms.
And we do use shorthand.
We do use shorthand, yeah. That's one of the problems with theories. It takes quite a while to get right down and explain all the nuts and bolts, but a bumper sticker-sized slogan will kind of encapsulate the whole thing.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And you make this point early on in the book that ethical theory, as opposed to applied ethics, in which we talk about case studies and that kind of thing, ethical theory seems to be, oh man, that's complicated. That's, pardon the expression, too philosophical or whatever. Mm-hmm. Why is it that it seems so daunting to us? Because it's part of all our lives.
Well, yeah, it's daunting precisely because you do have to think about it, and thinking is pretty hard work. And sometimes we're not always sure what the anchor points are for thinking. But there's another reason that I think theory gets a little bit daunting as well, and that is because when you get into certain areas of applied ethics, it's relatively easy to hold it at arm's length. But, you know, not a lot of us are going to be in situations where we have to decide who to throw off the lifeboat or things like that.
Yes.
But in kind of a counterintuitive way, I think theory is frightening to us precisely because it hits so close to us.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm disagreeing with somebody about a particular issue in applied ethics, I can see some of the logic in a contrary position. And I could see certain conditions under which I might say, well, I think maybe that's the best way. But when you get down to a theory, you're awfully close to our identity. And so when somebody says your theory is wrong, they're not just saying you've got a wrong conclusion, but there's something wrong about what you value very deeply.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that is challenging, even threatening, that's for sure. Another topic that you've written about and that you and I have talked about are worldviews. Christian and otherwise, how do you see the relationship between worldview and ethics?
The way we view our world, whether that's how we think that we come best to know things in it, what's most real about that, what our purpose is in that, will always bear some relationship to how we think about the good. So if I think that the most fundamental reality of the universe isn't God, but instead everything can be boiled down to material and its component parts, I'm not going to have much room for an ethical approach that is going to take God seriously. If, on the contrary, I take God very seriously and see God as the source of goodness, I'm going to have a hard time adopting certain ethical theories like behaviorism that tends to dismiss the possibility or probability of God's being.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the book, and I don't want to summarize the whole book, nor could I in the time that we have allotted here, but you make reference to and a whole slew of different types of ethical theories. And what I think, frankly, is brilliant is that you arrange them in such a way and write about them in such a way that we can make parallels, make comparisons relatively easily. And I, for one, really appreciated that. Even for those well acquainted with ethical theory, it's a good, relatively quick review. And as you point out, some ethical theories seem to be naturally friendly to classic Christian theology, while others, as you point out, are generally seen to be quite antagonistic to biblical Christianity. However, you identify positive aspects in such ethical perspectives as relativism or behaviorism, as you mentioned a moment ago, and even evolutionary ethics. Are you treading on dangerous ground?
Well, some people would certainly think so, but I have this impression that ethical theories gain staying power because they answer at least some questions very well, or address certain facets of human nature, human need, very well.
Yes.
Now, that may also come in a bigger package where, from a Christian perspective, as a whole, the system is just a non-starter. It's just not going to work. But even within them, there are certain facets. So, for example, with relativism, I often point out that most folks who claim to be relativists, ironically, aren't relativists because of some sort of philosophical conclusion they've drawn. Instead, it's usually a reaction to people who are moral absolutists. And sometimes those folks can be rather difficult to live with. They can be very annoying. And so, ironically, you have people who are moral relativists for moral reasons. They want folks to be a little more kind and tolerant and cut people some slack.
Yeah, can't we all just get along?
Yeah, can't we just get along? And there's something good about getting along. Or, you know, something like evolutionary ethics, which focuses a lot on the genetic structure of humans. Well, there is a biological, electrical, chemical infrastructure that is necessary for us to live ethical lives. And so, for example, we know intuitively, for example, that if somebody has been stricken with Alzheimer's and somebody who was formerly nice and kind and considerate becomes rather narcissistic and mean-spirited, we look to sorts of genetic and biological causes to help us understand how we should appropriately respond to those sorts of things. So yeah, I think if you really look at any system, you're going to find some bit of information that you can hang on to and say, yeah, within a limited scope, that helps us understand the way we're wired.
Because as you describe it, it's a system. That means there's just not one person in history who came up with the idea, but that others, for one reason or another, ascribe to that point of view, at least in some circumstances.
Yeah, there's going to be a certain resonance.
Yes. A detail, but I think a really important one. You suggest in your discussion of ethical egoism, that is, looking out for number one, that perhaps self-interest and concern for others are two sides of the same coin. Please explain that. I think that was really good.
Okay. Well, yeah, and, you know, self-interest is one of those things that is neither good nor bad in and of itself. It can manifest itself in quite positive and useful ways, but it can also turn ugly and be very destructive. So if I care about myself deeply and want the best for myself, I think that will drive me into a concern and a care and a love for other people. And similarly, if I happen to catch myself doing things that are beneficial to others, it gives me a deeper sense of self-regard. It's not like, you know, getting a trophy in soccer, you know, where everybody gets one, but there is a certain self-regard that is based on the sorts of behaviors that we intuitively think are beneficial, not just to others, but to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I would suggest, and this is not original with me, of course, it actually came up in a conversation I had many years ago with a mutual friend of ours, Rich Mao.
Yes.
I would suggest, as he did, that many people, Christians included, argue from a utilitarian, the best, the most good for the highest number, from a utilitarian standpoint, in their public lives, in the public square, in public discussions, and then from a duty or a virtue perspective in private conversations. Do you agree?
You know, I'd get very nervous if I found myself in a position where I had to disagree with Rich Mao. He's an awfully bright guy and has good insights. And in this case,
he just said that in one conversation. I'm not quoting from one of his books.
Yes, yes. But I do agree with him. Utilitarianism grows up as a system with democracy. And there's an inherent connection between the two. When we function in a democracy, we recognize that we have to find ways to live with people who don't always hold the same values that we have. And so we've got to find a way to achieve this goal of the greatest happiness for the greatest number. We do that every time we take a vote. Not everybody is happy with the way the vote turns out, but we also recognize that it's better to live with the candidate that somebody else would prefer than to end up with revolution or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it happens to be a fairly efficient way of dealing with a cultural public sort of setting where you can't assume the same sorts of values, desires, aims, and goals. However, when we're in the realm of private discourse, this is where our values really kick in, and we seek for ways to express those through our behaviors. And so, yeah, those values will inform what we take to be our duties, or they will shape the sorts of virtues and dispositions that we see as necessary to get at the aims that we desire.
So in the public square, there's kind of an inherent acceptance of at least some measure of compromise, whereas we can be more pointed in our individual conversations. Is that what you're driving at?
Yeah, and that's really an interesting discussion that we so often don't have in Christian circles.
Yes.
In what way do we function best within a public realm where not everybody shares Christian commitments?
Mm-hmm. Another detail in your book that I thought was really interesting, you use a popular movie, The March of the Penguins, as a poignant illustration. What can we learn from the March of the Penguins movie about ethics?
Well, in this particular movie, it's a documentary that journals the travels of emperor penguins to their breeding ground. So at a particular time of year, they start this long journey, I think it's 60, 70 miles. And if you've ever watched a penguin walk, you'll soon discover that they weren't really designed for that sort of hiking.
Mm.
And they end up in these breeding grounds where, through something that is totally mysterious to us, they start to match up, male and female. And during that season, anyway, they are deeply committed to each other. So they breed, the female lays an egg, and as soon as the egg is laid, the male keeps it warm with his body while the female walks back about another 80 miles to start feeding. And so she gorges herself for a couple of weeks and then makes the walk back. And by then, the chick is often born. She'll take over responsibilities and the male goes back. Now, involved in all of this is behaviors that appear, at least on the surface, to be unselfish, because they put the penguins engaging in these activities in dangerous circumstances. And that seems to at least mirror what we would think of as unselfish behavior.
Yeah, then the documentary we would need to add was has taken some dramatic license, but nonetheless, a pretty good illustration.
Yeah, now the interesting thing, though, is we see those some of those same sorts of behaviors in humans, where we'll often do dangerous things to protect others. What's quite different here, though, within humans, is that we seem to be, A, capable of reflecting on these things and choosing whether we ought to act altruistically, while the penguins just seem to do it because that's what they're programmed to do. But secondly, this beneficial behavior is very limited to kin groups. And mm-hmm. So if there's an intruder from the outside, the penguins will act very aggressively. In contrast, human behaviors will quite often extend benevolence to people who are unknown. And we might even do things like love our enemies. So while there are certain things that seem to, at least on the surface, mirror human altruism in the actions of the emperor penguin, the two additional factors add just a whole new dimension.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to reflect on some experience that I've had as a pastor and as a military chaplain with regard to ethics, feelings, and actions. In my years of experience, I witnessed countless lives being, from my perspective, wasted because people believe that actions should be based on feelings. You know, a small example, you know, the student who says to you that he, you know, didn't get up because he didn't feel like getting up, or the student who says, you know, well, I'll do a much better job and I'll study much more efficiently when I feel like it. I don't want to force myself to do it now. However, I personally would insist that for actual happiness and life satisfaction to occur, people need to practice ethically integrated, godly behaviors and trust that the feelings which they desire will follow. Now, that doesn't translate very well into a bumper sticker, though, does it?
Yeah. No, I'm not sure how you would squeeze that onto a bumper sticker. But quite often what we don't recognize is that our immediate emotional responses to things really represent commitments and decisions that we've already made.
Hmm.
And so over the last days, I've been following a story where somebody on death row was eventually executed last night.
Yes.
And there are, you see the whole range of emotional responses to that. Some feel quite relieved that it's happened. Others are quite angry, feel it's a great tragedy. And so you have the same event, two different, very different emotional responses, but those emotional responses aren't untethered. They don't just float around and happen to people.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they grow out of certain values and commitments and beliefs that we already have. So, I think, as Aristotle tells us, that that feelings are not good or bad in themselves, but we start to learn how to feel the right way about the right things at the right times by, first of all, adopting the right behaviors and then internalizing those so they become deeply embedded virtues or dispositions.
Yes, some classic Christian author whom I read many years ago, I can't remember his name, but he said something, so to speak, in his prayer life or in the context of his dialogue with his God and with himself, saying to his body, all right, I went with you three times today to eat, and I took you to bed last night so you could be rested. Now you come with me to pray,
yes.
You know, to make that behavior commitment. Now, Christians perhaps are not ruled by bumper sticker ethics, but many of us like to simplify things. We said this at the very beginning, that we like to live our life by, when we can, by kind of short rules, easy to remember, uncomplicated things. And lots of Christians of my acquaintance, and I dare say yours as well, would say that the real essence of ethics is our Lord Jesus Christ's two-part love command about loving God above all else and loving our neighbor as ourselves. Isn't that sufficient for Christians? Loaded question.
Wow, that's a hard question to answer. And I would say that it would be sufficient if, as long as we recognize that it's a command.
Yes.
And you don't command things that people automatically do. And so it seems that embedded in this notion of a command, that it requires a transformation of our will, that Jesus only has to tell us to do that because we have difficulty doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very simple, and as he says, it sums up the entire law. But there's a lot beneath that, because we don't often want to love God. We don't
yes.
want to love others.
Precisely.
And the various forms that love should take, you know, the decisions we make that would express that love, aren't always clear to us.
That's for sure. Before we run completely out of time, one more detail. On page 188, you write that you have, quote, little use for most radio talk shows. Now, I'm trusting that our program Centered is an exception to that.
It is an exception. I mean, this is the third time you've invited me back very graciously, and I am quite happy to have the opportunity to visit with you again. So, yeah, I appreciate the fact that you ask questions, and there is that searching, learning spirit there rather than just looking for somebody to express an angle. So,
yeah,
so you're excluded from the category.
Okay, thanks. I'm much relieved. but in all seriousness, Professor Steve Wilkins, thank you so much for being on Centered again.
I'm honored to be part of it.
And for everybody, it's a neat book, a great review, or a very potent introduction. Beyond Bumper Sticker Ethics, an introduction to theories of right and wrong. And if you have questions or comments, please go ahead and communicate with me directly. My email address is dgb@centeredonline.org. A final thought about our conversation about bumper stickers. As you probably know, morality and ethics are not the same thing, though they are certainly directly related. I believe that carefully thought about ethics are an essential support structure for our morality. I mean, the better we can describe our ethics, the more persuasive and clear we can be in serious conversations with other people. However, for followers of Jesus Christ, He is our foundation. Our relationship to Him and the ways in which we honor what He taught determine how we view the world and how we view our lives. For example, the Apostle John writes in his second epistle, chapter 1, verses 5 and 6, "I am not writing you a new command, but one we have had from the beginning. I ask that we love one another, and this is love, that we walk in obedience to Jesus' commands. As you have heard from the beginning, His command is that you walk in love." Can we disagree about this way of love? Sure. That's where careful study of the whole Bible, mature thought, and respectful words come in. But when we open ourselves completely to the promptings of God's holy and loving Spirit, we'll be on track. Centered.
Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for your kind and thoughtful attention. Yeah, and check out our website. Remember, it's www.centeredonline.org.